4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell, in for Veronica Rickard. Later in the hour, we'll be discussing addiction with the physician director of the Betty Ford Clinic. First, though, Metro Transit in Madison is asking for input from the public on how they can improve the city's public transit system. They're going to be holding meetings on October 9th, as well as a Twitter chat on October 11th.
Well, that inspired us to do a statewide sort of version of that. We want to hear your thoughts, and you can join in, on how transportation in your community and around the state can be improved. From buses to highways, trains, bikes, you name it. What would make it easier for you to get around in your part of Wisconsin? You can give a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you could post on the Central Time Facebook page. That's Central Time on WPR. Well, to start off the conversation, we have Craig Thompson. He's executive director of the Transportation Development Alliance, Association of Wisconsin. Craig, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, apart from fixing that bridge in Green Bay, what would be the biggest improvement you could see to our transportation system in Wisconsin?
Well, if you look at, for the most part, our system, it's a lot of it is maintaining what we have, especially at the local level, which comprises, in terms of the roadways, about 90% of the system. It really is just trying to get in better repair of the system we already have. As far as major improvements, a lot of that would come in the form of what's going on in the interstate in southeast Wisconsin, the Zoo Interchange, what we've already done in Marquette, I-94 from the airport to the Chicago line, and then potentially I-3990 here from Madison to Chicago. Those would probably be the areas, in terms of when you talk about roads, that, where the improvements would come in.
Mm-hmm. So with an unlimited budget, which I know we never have, but what kind of changes, I'm going to throw some different things at you, what changes would you make to, say, public transportation?
Well, one of the changes that we are advocating for public transportation actually does have to do with budgets. So we do believe that, like most areas of the country, local communities should have the ability to raise the money themselves. And we think when people have the decision and the money stays locally, they'll interact a lot more and make other decisions. But if that occurred, you know, for example, here in Madison, Madison Metro has studied looking at bus rapid transit, which is a way of having bus routes operate almost more like local trains, but without the hard track. And there'd be stations and that would be at grade where you could get on and off and they go faster. I think some of the things like that would be very interesting and could be helpful.
We're having a little open forum on transportation in Wisconsin. We want to hear what you think in your community. Do you need the roads fixed? Do you want to see more bike lanes, trains, buses, two-lane roads, four-lane roads, you name it? What would make it easier for you to get around Wisconsin? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. Bikes are big in some of the cities and now smaller communities around the state too. What kind of opportunities do you see for improving bike conditions in the state?
You know, bikes really are big in Wisconsin, both from us riding them and as a bike industry. So a lot of times when we think about improvements for bikes, we think of bike trails and that, and that's certainly important. There's some great ones in Wisconsin. But a lot of what can happen, too, is there's, at the federal level, there's what they call complete streets legislation, so that when we are redoing and rebuilding streets, that we do it in a way that accommodates so that we can ride our bikes on there as well and feel safe doing it. So I think a lot of times it's the roads themselves that can be more accommodating to bikes in addition to the trails.
Do we think about pedestrians enough, especially in town, city environments? I know there was an effort some years back to try to get more walkable communities in Wisconsin. I don't know whatever happened to that. Is that a big factor when people are developing their roadways?
You know, I think it is in areas that are more metropolitan, like Milwaukee and Madison. You do need some level of density, I think, for it to factor in, you know, a lot. You know, we are pretty spread out in Wisconsin. We've got a lot of medium-sized cities and a lot of more rural areas. But I think in Madison, Milwaukee, and maybe even Eau Claire, La Crosse, some of those areas, I think it certainly is a factor.
We'll go to the phones now. We have Marina in Pleasant Prairie. Marina, hi. Welcome to the show.
Yes, hello. Good afternoon. Listen, I live in Pleasant Prairie, and I'm used to living in the various cities, the suburbs of various cities, and who had commuter trains. It was wonderful. You could go to the ballparks, to the art institutes, to the operas. Sadly to say, in Wisconsin, that is not true. I don't have the ease of the access to the places that I've mentioned, and it greatly restricts, and just as you were talking about the opera center, the operas having to needing to expand their base, well, a lot of that eliminates people such as myself, schools and things like that, seniors who would be interested in visiting those spaces, but for lack of, you know, a ready access.
All right, Marina, thanks a lot for calling in and getting us started. Craig, commuter rail in Wisconsin.
Well, you know, there was some talk of light rail here in Madison, and that became pretty controversial back when there was legislation for RTA. But I think that's one of the reasons that Madison Metro is looking at, and the city, I think the mayor is looking at bus rapid transit, because I think it could accomplish really some of those same things, especially here on the Isthmus, that the caller's talking about, without necessarily having all of the costs of fixed rail, that we could, through our corridors, do some pretty innovative things to make some bus routes, you know, operate more like commuter rail.
And, of course, rail has been controversial in Wisconsin, to say the least, not just commuter rail, but intercity rail, with the almost happening federal plan for trains in Wisconsin and then gone. Is that a done deal, never coming back?
Well, you never say never,
I mean,
right?
I'm talking the Milwaukee to Madison connection. Right. Obviously, we have Milwaukee up to the Twin Cities and Chicago.
You know, as far as high-speed rail in Wisconsin, it doesn't appear that it would be on the horizon in the immediate future after, you know, some of the things that have transpired. I think that would be – that's probably a safe bet at this point.
All right. We'll get back to the phones now. We have Barbara in Waupaca. Hi, Barbara.
Hi. I am in favor of looking at bus or train transportation in rural areas. It seems to me that a healthy rural way of life is as important to our nation's success, you know, going forward, as a healthy urban way of life.
Gotcha. And, you're cutting in and out there a little, Barbara, but I think point taken. And also Ezra on Facebook writes, I wish public transportation were more accessible, especially in rural areas. How is it's got to be hard. There's not that density to get a public transit system in there.
Yeah, you know, in a lot of the rural areas, we do more shared ride, taxi, and some of those. And I certainly don't want to belittle the concerns of the caller and others, because I think they're very legitimate. But I know in this we're trying to talk about what we could do, but when we do overlay the funding situation we have, and you have to prioritize, it is just tough, because in the rural areas, just trying to maintain the roadways that we have, we're falling behind. We're not able to do it. And for what we have been doing, we're getting further and further into debt, because we've been borrowing to do it rather than coming up with the money. So, you know, it gets to be balancing priorities. And I fully understand it. It's just, it gets tough, you know, with when we have trouble paying for the system that we currently have.
Thanks a lot for the call. We've got John in Hudson now. Hi, John.
Well, I agree with the last call, and I think that Mr. Thompson is absolutely incorrect. We need to have more mass transit because millennials are not buying cars. And we do need to make sure that we have funding to fix up our roads, but we do not need to be expanding roads. Individuals with disabilities have no way of getting from city to city right now. There is no bus service from Wausau to Madison. You know, and rail is the way to go. We should have done this, the rail from Milwaukee to Minneapolis, but we didn't want to do that because everybody saw that it's Milwaukee to Madison.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call, John. He says, let's key in that first point. Millennials are less interested in cars. Obviously, a lot of them are still driving cars, but do you see that as a trend?
Well, you know, that's been a real interesting topic lately. First of all, I do want to say that I'm certainly not advocating against mass transit.
Right.
That's not what I was trying to say. There has been a lot of talk about whether we are, the millennials and others, are sort of eschewing cars. And I think it's a little early to tell. It appears that there might be something to that. Vehicle miles traveled has flattened and declined even a bit. Now, that does tend to happen during recession, which we had. But there does seem to be something more than that there. So it is a little bit hard to tell how much of that is from the recession and how much of that's going to be a hard trend moving forward. But we also have to look at, even when statewide, you know, you could look at VMT or vehicle miles traveled numbers, but then you also have to look specifically along different corridors where you're talking, whether there's going to be increased traffic along those areas as well.
All right. Well, before we're done, you mentioned at the outset, keeping those roads going is part of the big issue facing the state, obviously bridges too. What's the next big challenge as far as keeping that infrastructure up?
Well, I think it really is, again, for the vast majority of our system, finding the funding to just maintain, not expand, but maintain the level that we have with our local roads and our bridges and the state highways. I think it's finding a sustainable source to be able to just keep that in good repair.
All right, Craig, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
You can continue the conversation on the Central Time Facebook page. Hey, you're obviously interested in transportation issues. We'll have more conversations like this one coming up on future shows.
Right now, we'll be checking the headlines, and then we'll be back with the physician director of the Betty Ford Clinic speaking on addiction. You're listening to Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll get our weekly check of the news in Wisconsin with WPR News Director Michael Leland.
First, though, we're going to be talking about addiction. It's a disease that affects 1 in 10 people in the United States, and it's often fatal.
You can join in the show. Have you battled addiction in your life, or has someone close to you? Call in and share your experiences, and hopefully maybe your story of recovery, too. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email talk@WPR.org.
Our guest for this segment is Dr. Harry Haritunian. He is the author of Being Sober, a step-by-step guide to getting to, getting through, and living in recovery. He is the physician director of the Betty Ford Center. Doctor, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
I'd like to start with your story a bit. There's a narrative that runs throughout the book that sort of outlines your journey, and it begins and ends in Vermont.
That's right. I practiced family medicine in Vermont for 35 years, and part of my story was being a solo family practice physician, oftentimes the only one in town, very few boundaries on getting a good night's sleep, or you simply could not be unavailable. The stresses and strains of that kind of practice, plus my own family's history of the disease of addiction, certainly came together in a perfect storm. And as you can see in the book, I got into my own personal recovery some years ago.
Yeah, and in the book, the story in Vermont begins when you meet a rookie police officer who arrests you for a DUI, and the journey continues throughout the book. It ends when you meet him again when he's wearing sergeant stripes.
Yeah, that's he was being trained that evening. Actually, the training officer was a longtime friend of mine who I knew very well, and I actually knew this young rookie cop, told him to do his job. Some years later, we met, and he had actually become a state trooper. We met on a one-lane wooden bridge in Vermont, and I got out of my car, approached the trooper's car, and thanked him for saving my life.
And tell me also about your journey from being that doctor in Vermont to becoming the physician director of the Betty Ford Center, because there's a story there, too, and you both treat patients, of course, but being the physician director at Betty Ford's a very different thing.
Well, first of all, I'd like to say it's an absolute pleasure being interviewed by someone who's obviously read the book. So thank you for that.
Sure.
You know, as that process around the DUI became evident and I had to deal with it and speak with the authorities, I was approached by the Vermont State Physicians Health Program, a wonderful program that exists now in about 46 of the states. I never knew it existed. But it's a specific program that helps physicians in need of help for the disease of addiction to get it and to be able to get successfully treated, find recovery, and get back to work. It was through these folks that I was referred on to the Betty Ford Center. I did so voluntarily and with some great enthusiasm. I had seen this disease at work in my family. My brother and my father both died of this disease, and I certainly didn't want the same fate, so I got fairly proactive, entered the Betty Ford Center as a patient the first time. embraced the recovery and found a whole new way of life. I went back to Vermont for 5 years. I knew that my solo family practice was really a dinosaur kind of practice that was just too much for one person. The hospitals needed to come in and take over with multiple physicians. That was too much for one person. I studied and took my boards in addiction medicine and became board certified and was offered a position by the people at the Betty Ford Center, where I had continued to go annually as a volunteer and a lecturer after my recovery.
So let's talk about the book a little bit. Who is the audience for this book? It's described as being a step-by-step guide, and it really is, as you look through it. Is this designed for people who are addicted, for families of those who might be addicted, or for who?
All of the above. The book was designed really as a reference, a guidebook for the identified patient or soon to be identified patient, that person primarily afflicted directly by the disease. But we know that this is a family disease and everyone needs to get help or the outcome is not great. So it's for family members. It's for healthcare professionals, anyone who has a loved one or a friend that needs to know more about the disease and how to approach them, hopefully getting rid of the stigma that prevents treatment and intervention and allowing people to begin the healing both personally and as a family unit. So we hope that anyone will be helped by this book. It's also a very simplified guide. Some of the literature is a bit complicated. The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, for example, is a somewhat tedious volume for someone to understand early on, and people need to have sometimes that literature explained. There is an attempt at that also in the book.
You mentioned the word stigma a few minutes ago, and throughout the conversation, you've been referring to the addiction as a disease. And even in 2013, I'm not sure that everybody believes that they believe it's a disease, that it's not just a weakness of character or something. Is that something that you still run into?
Oh, I run into it constantly, including my brothers and sisters in the medical profession, who need to have enormous efforts at educating medical students and physicians out there in practice that this is a disease, much like diabetes or hypertension. It is chronic, organic disease of the brain. It's lifelong. It is not curable, but it is absolutely treatable one day at a time. Again, much like diabetes. But most people have some sort of personal history. Someone afflicted in their family, some encounter while in college. They remember the alcoholic or addict on the streets near their home. They have distorted images rather than the successful people that we often treat. Sometimes the paper bag toting wino is the only image that they can get. People searching through dumpsters. There's an enormous stigma about this disease that's shrouded with shame and indignity, and it oftentimes will force people into malignant denial and shield them from the help that's out there and so readily available. So we're trying to have people get access. They're sick. They need to be treated. They don't need to be punished. And that's the way we approach it.
And one of the things you talk about, you spend a considerable amount of time in the book talking about a concept of the high-functioning addict. And could you discuss that for a minute or so?
Well, that just happens to be a personal area of specialty for me. I have a professionals program at the Betty Ford Center and a wonderful team of treating professionals. We deal with physicians, pilots, attorneys, business people, entertainers, people who have oftentimes arrived at the juncture where they needed treatment, not because of enormous failure, but sometimes because of their success. people who have had financial success or professional success oftentimes feel entitled. They feel like they, more than anyone else, should be able to control their use of drugs or alcohol. They find themselves trapped just like everyone else. There are no special people in this game. Everybody's playing on an equal field, and alcohol and drugs are equal opportunity destroyers.
And we'll have to leave it there for the break for the news. And when we return, we'll continue our discussion with Dr. Harry Haritunian, the author of Being Sober, a step-by-step guide to getting to, getting through, and living in recovery.
You can join in with your questions and experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett.
And I'm Gene Purcell. We're talking with Dr. Harry Haritunian this hour. He is the physician director of the Betty Ford Center and the author of the book we're talking about, Being Sober, a step-by-step guide to getting to, getting through, and living in recovery.
You can join with your questions, your experiences at 800-642-1234 or send an email, talk@wpr.org.
And we've got plenty of callers who would like to join in, and we begin with Lynn, who joins us from Eau Claire. Hi, Lynn.
Good afternoon. I lost my brother to the addiction to alcohol January 2nd of this year. And begging him the last 20 years to get help. My brother was brilliant. I think the first truth of addiction is lie. It was all lies. And I held his hand, and there was no help. There was no place to turn because he was he could make that decision to destroy himself, and there's so many victims. There's so many victims.
Lynn, thanks so much for the call, and we are so sorry for your loss. Doctor, as you hear Lynn's story, you sort of hear the helplessness, I think, that goes along with a lot of the family members who deal with family members with addiction or close friends with addiction. What advice do you have for someone like Lynn who might be listening right now, who might have a close friend or a loved one who is having some of these symptoms, who has the disease?
Well, I also would like to express my my feelings about your loss. Very sorry. I actually carry the ashes of my deceased brother on my keychain, a little fob that I have, and introduce him when I speak at lectures to remind people of the fatal nature of this disease. Your brother didn't choose to die. This disease hijacks the brain and simply makes alcohol and or drugs, in the case of addiction to drugs, a top priority, more important than life itself. It's not a choice. It is a disease that affects that portion of our brain that deals with survival. So with a hijacked brain, we really have the deck stacked against us when someone adds to that denial or resistance to help. But for families, it's critical to know a couple of things. First of all, help doesn't mean that you need to come up with $100,000 for treatment. Help can be as simple as calling someone else who you may or may not know in recovery to bring someone to their first 12-step meeting. Even if a family member will not get help, it is imperative that the family members themselves get help. And we oftentimes will start the healing in a family first by the persons who are not afflicted by the disease directly, but the family members. So organizations like 12-step meetings for family members, Al-Anon therapy, individual therapy, drug counsel organizations throughout each and every state dealing with drug abuse are usually available and offered. And the healing can begin sometimes in that way. There's a way to network with other people whose families are in recovery, sooner or later some help will come along, and the healing can begin. So for those of you who don't have such unfortunate stories as the caller, we encourage you to seek any and all help that's available through these agencies and through the 12-step programs or individual private counselors.
We've got another call now from Claudia, who joins us in Madison. Hi, Claudia.
Hi. My question is, like, I have a nephew that is going through addiction problems, and he's been in an institution for a couple of months, and they said there's a treatment, short treatment for 7 months, and he get out. But right now he's experimenting some voices, and I would like to know what is the relationship between the addiction and his and mental illness, because that's something that kind of go together. But we, in this moment, we don't know how to or where to go in order to be treat that addiction or mental illness. I don't know how that is connected. I don't know if it's because he did too much drugs that his brain got damaged.
Well, let's put it to the doctor, Claudia. What about that when there is a mental health issue involved in the addiction?
Well, oftentimes mental health issues and addiction will go hand in hand. It's called dual diagnosis. Oftentimes, the mental health issue may be substance related and will improve greatly when cessation of the use of alcohol or drugs happens. And oftentimes, the psychiatric problem is an independent disorder which needs independent individual treatment. It sounds as though that may be the case, since usually in institutions people are screened and monitored for drug use. So assuming that your relative is abstinent right now, psychiatric help and evaluation would be what is needed for sure. There are medications that can absolutely help, and oftentimes I need to say this, that independent psychiatric problems may need proper evaluation and medication and does not preclude good recovery from alcohol or drug dependence.
We have time for a quick call from Jim, who joins us from Johnson Creek. Hi, Jim.
Hello.
You're on the air.
I am an addict, and I'm in recovery. Been clean for, 4 years now. And I just wanted to say that, you know, absolutely, if anybody out there is getting to the point where they're getting tired of it or getting desperate, that there is definitely help. And there's, you know, I mean, personally, myself, I'm going to AA. I know that addicts are generally supposed to go to NA, but it doesn't feel right to me. And there aren't as many NA meetings out there as should be at this point, with the problems coming across Wisconsin and the United States in a whole. But, you know, there's always help, and the doors are always open at the meetings. And, you know, if you're getting to a place where you just are getting tired of the same old garbage that comes with that life, by all means, look, go online to alcoholicsanonymous.org and find a meeting.
Jim, thanks for your perspective. It's really good to hear that. Dr. Haritunian, a good place to maybe end on this is, we heard Jim's story, and in your book, you know, you talk about the step-by-step guide, but at no point is it implied in the book that this is an easy process.
Recovery is a lot of hard work. It's a very simple program, but it takes determination, it takes prayer, it takes a lot of effort. So it's simple, it is not easy, but one day at a time, sometimes 1 hour at a time. The message of the book and the message to all of your listeners out there is absolute hope. I have never seen a hopeless case. and always hold hope out that someone with the right help and with the right intention opens them up to the grace of some higher power, whatever they may choose that to be in their life, other than themselves, and help is always available.
Well, Dr. Harry Haritunian, thanks so much for joining us today.
I greatly appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
We've been talking with Dr. Harry Haritunian, the author of the book we've been discussing, Being Sober, A Step-by-Step Guide to Getting to, Getting Through, and Living in Recovery. He is the physician director of the Betty Ford Center.
Coming up next, WPR News Director Michael Leland will join us. He'll round up some of the week's top news stories from around the state and a lot of things going on at the federal level that are affecting us here in Wisconsin. The Affordable Care Act, the federal government shutdown. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, education expert Diane Ravitch joins us. We'll talk about her new book, Reign of Error. She'll share her concerns about school privatization.
But first, it's time for our weekly look at what made news in Wisconsin this week with WPR News Director Michael Leland.
Michael, welcome to Central Time.
Nice to be here.
Well, some big stories this week, a couple of them courtesy of the federal government. First of all, the Affordable Care Act, those health care exchanges are in place now.
Exactly. About 700,000 people in Wisconsin are expected to enroll in the new Affordable Care Act through these exchanges that are being set up by the federal government. That began on Tuesday, and that enrollment period is going to run through the end of March.
But
if you want coverage to begin on January 1st, you've got to enroll by December 15th.
Now, this is a big deal in Wisconsin. We heard very recently letters going out to a bunch of Wisconsinites saying, you're off Badger Care, start making plans.
Right. 92,000 people in Wisconsin who are on Badger Care now, that's the state's Medicaid program, they're being moved off because of changes in how the state sets requirements to be on it. In the past, Badger Care had covered adults who have kids who would have incomes up to 200% of the federal poverty level. That's been cut back to 100%, and those people in that middle range now who are on Badger Care will lose their coverage at the end of December. So they're the ones who are facing that December 15th deadline to get coverage through this new system beginning on January 1st.
And without having a lapse in coverage then.
Exactly.
So what have we been hearing about how opening day and opening week went?
Well, again, because these are the federal exchanges that people in Wisconsin are using because the state declined to set up its own exchanges, it's happening here in Wisconsin as it's happening around the country that are also using the federal system. The healthcare.gov website has been reported as being very slow. A lot of people have been going to that site saying that they are taking, you know, nearly forever to get on if they're able to sign on at all. And a lot of people, 7 million people tried to get on that site Tuesday and Wednesday, and the federal government says it's trying to come up with ways to expand the volume. But so far, it's been slow going through that federal exchange system.
One of our guests this week said a lot of the traffic was probably reporters going on there.
Could have been.
To check it out. Well, the other big federal story this week is the federal government shutdown, still rolling as of right now. How is that affecting us here in Wisconsin in particular?
Well, you know, it's, obviously far fewer federal workers here in Wisconsin than in many other states. But there are a lot of noticeable things, people like civilian workers for the National Guard, things like the Apostle Islands, the National Lakeshore. That's been closed down. There's no camping. There's no hiking. The tour boats that will take you out there are still operating, but they can only get to within about a quarter mile of the islands. I'm not sure what kind of enforcement is being done along with that, but a quarter mile is as close as they can get.
It's not the same as the camping trip some people might have been planning. Like,
no.
That's your campsite over there.
Right.
You can swim for it if you want.
If you can make it, you can camp. No, that is not true.
Oh.
You can't camp on the islands for as long as the shutdown goes on. Mm-hmm. The Upper Mississippi Wildlife Refuge near Trempealeau is closed, and the federally run part of Horicon Marsh is closed. The state-run part is still open.
So that's a lot of the natural areas in the state. We talked yesterday a little bit about the impact on scientific research. What are we hearing here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, here at UW-Madison, the school gets about $500 million in federal research grants. And right now, there's nobody processing further grant applications or even available to answer questions. So any grant applications that are underway are kind of slowed by this. It's also tougher to get access to some types of data through the National Science Foundation and things like that. Also, where the UW has workers who are working on federal projects, they've been told by agencies like the National Institutes of Health or the National Park Service to stop working on some of these projects. And so right now the UW is in some cases trying to figure out what the employment status is of its workers who are assigned to work with these agencies.
Anything in particular you've seen that hasn't been affected that people might be interested in?
Yeah, if you are applying for financial aid with one of your college-bound children or you are awaiting payment for financial aid you've already been approved for, that is not being interrupted. The government says there's only a slight impact on the application process or the delivery of aid that's already been granted. So if you've gotten an award letter, the government says you will get your money.
Well, this is one we're going to be following for the minutes or months or some point in between that this shutdown goes on.
Well, unlike some, we don't have a countdown clock in the corner of our radio,
right.
We're up to, 4 days and counting now.
Right. Well, here's one story that's still early, kind of in the works, but it made a big splash this week. A change in the way public employees in Wisconsin get health care coverage. What's going on there?
Yeah, more than a 250,000 state workers and their family members in Wisconsin currently get their health coverage through HMOs. It's a competitive HMO system. They offer prices in order to get to get people to sign up with them. The governor is exploring the idea of going to what's called a self-insured health coverage program. 20 states do this sort of thing already. A little bit of how it works, a traditional HMO, the state pays premiums to the HMO, you pay part of it, and then the HMO pays for your health coverage. And then under a self-insured program, the state actually pays the actual cost of providing health care to its workers, and the state and workers do still set aside money. It's a lot like premiums to cover those costs.
What kind of numbers are being thrown around in the early stages here?
The state has commissioned a few studies to look into this, and they have found that the state could save anywhere from $20 million a year by switching to a self-insurance program, or could end up paying another $100 million. So it's sort of all over the map. Another study found that the state could save maybe 4 to 5% on its current insurance costs. That's about $1 billion a year. But it also found that in the current system, where the HMOs compete for state business, that saves about that much already.
Hmm. And have we been here before? Have we had this model in place before in Wisconsin?
Yeah, about 30 years ago, Wisconsin had a self-insured model. And the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel has reported this week that it spoke to the man who used to run that system for the state, and he said that he's not sure why they'd want to go back, because the state gave up on this self-insured model after costs jumped more than 20% 2 years in a row in the early 80s.
This is in the early stages, a lot more question marks than answers at this point. Where are we? What would a timeline look like?
Well, the governor had a conversation this week with insurance and health executives, and he says right now there's no proposal just yet. He's just collecting information to see what makes the most sense. There's going to be more talk about it next week when the group insurance board meets. That's the board that oversees the state insurance program. And the governor says it's possible that a decision on going ahead with this could be made by early next year, or it's possible that the state will stay with its current HMO system.
I know, again, there's a lot we don't know. I'm guessing public employees' unions may look at this with some suspicion based on their past interactions with the governor.
Yeah, already rumblings from some that this is just another swing at state workers by the governor. The governor says he's just looking for the best bargain for taxpayers and state workers. So, we'll see where this goes.
All right. Another one we've been watching. We talked to Patty Murray a little while back about this bridge in Green Bay sagging.
Yes.
What's the latest on that?
the Leo Frigo Bridge, that's the bridge that carries I-43 across Green Bay and the Fox River in downtown Green Bay. It's been closed for about a week and a half since one of the piers that's actually on the land side of the bridge sank. It sank into the ground about 2 feet, causing a sag in the roadway, and the state shut that bridge down. This week, the state has done some investigating and says that it appears that this sag was caused by corrosion in a steel piling under the bridge. Now, just to tell you how these bridges are, this is my oversimplified way of explaining how these bridges are built. You can see the concrete piers that hold up the roadway. They sink about 10 feet into the ground, but they're sitting on top of steel pilings that are driven about 100 feet into the ground.
Wow.
So you put the pilings in, you build the bridge on top of it, and what's happening is that those that one piling where the sag has happened has been corroding. The state says it may be a combination of foundry sand and organic material that's in the fill that was used to create the bed to put the bridge on, along with a change in the water table over the 30 years or so that bridge has been built. They think that's what may have caused the corrosion, but they did some looking around. They said it appears to be isolated in that general area and that the bridge is not in any danger of collapsing.
Well, that's some good news. I mean, I think when people hear about bridge problems, they think about that horrible collapse over in Minnesota.
In Minnesota, sure.
Yeah, so that's not about to happen. But this doesn't sound cheap and easy.
No, it is not going to be cheap. It's not going to be easy. The state is saying this bridge is likely to be closed through the winter. There'll be a lot more checking of it to see just, what needs to be done to restore it. One bit of good news we got today from the federal government, it's approved emergency money for repairs. It'll pay 100% of repair costs for the next 6 months and then 90% after that. And that'll be important because early estimates, and it could grow a lot higher, early estimates for fixing that bridge are coming in at about $50 million so
Whoa.
Far. Yeah.
Wow. And how big an impact is this on Green Bay and, I guess, looking forward, the Packer home game?
Well, I mean, just in getting around Green Bay, Patty has told you and us that, it's taking her longer to get to work because she lives on one side of the river and her office is on the other. Sunday is the first Packers home game since the bridge was closed, and the state and the team are saying that if you're heading to the game, leave earlier than usual, because even if you're not planning to take that bridge, the 30,000 or so cars a day on a Sunday that would ordinarily be on the bridge are not going to be on it. They've got to go somewhere else. So they'll be keeping you company on the road up to the stadium. So they are suggesting that you get out there earlier than usual. There'll be extra state patrols and Wisconsin Department of Transportation workers to kind of, keep things moving. But, I think they're not sure yet what it's going to look like on Sunday. But, if you've got tickets to the game, you would do well to leave a bit early.
And what's the early timeline on bridge repair for it being reopened?
They don't have a definite time when it could be repaired, but they're saying that it is likely to be closed into next year at the least. It's really going to depend on what needs to be done to fix it.
All right. Well, a lot to talk about. Michael, thanks so much for joining us.
All right. Happy to be here.
Catching up on the news of the week with Wisconsin Public Radio News Director Michael Leland.
Coming up, we'll talk with education Diane Ravitch. Her new book is Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and the Danger to America's Public Schools. We've done some coverage of schools lately. We had Ron Paul talking about his new book, movie director M. Night Shyamalan talking about his cures for education, and now education writer, former Undersecretary of Education Diane Ravitch will join us. She's warning of the movement toward vouchers, toward more testing, and other things in public education.
We're going to be taking a break now for news from National Public Radio and catching up on news from Wisconsin Public Radio as well. You're listening to Central Time here on Wisconsin Public Radio.